I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Lisa Ellery, the author of Hot Ground, just about to hit bookstores and no doubt going to be talked about a lot. Welcome, Lisa.
Oh, thanks very much, Michael. It's great to be here.
I'm holding a book up here. It's got a great cover.
Yes, it's nice, isn't it?
As a small boy, I lived in Kalgoorlie.
Did you?
Later on, I lived in Southern Cross as a teenager.
Yeah, right.
And later on professionally, including with a client I had who was a little bit like a hot ground expert, trying to claim other people's claims.
Yes.
I visited the area a lot, and this cover sort of has it all. It's got disused equipment. There's a mining shaft there that's probably been around for 100 years or more, and some
and
places where an old prospector would probably go and hang out on weekends.
Yeah, it's a very moody kind of a cover. The colours are just beautiful. And as are the colours in the Goldfields, really. That's what I loved about it.
It's a great place. And you know Kalgoorlie.
Yes, I know it very well. I've lived there for 25 years, or thereabouts.
Well, this is your second novel. You must feel like an old hand now. Your first through Fremantle Press.
I feel like I'm not a one-hit wonder, which is great.
Well, plainly not. And Fremantle Press and their editors are very good at identifying good writing talent, particularly in the crime thriller area.
Yeah. It's a real honour to be published by Fremantle Press.
It's really a huge honour.
Because they won't publish something just because they think it's, you know, going to sell a lot of books. It has to be good. So I'm very proud of that.
Yeah. Well, you ought to be. Now, the first one was Private Prosecution.
That's right.
This one, Hot Ground. There's some, in a sense, overlap of characters or bringing people who were in the last into this one.
Yes, it's sort of set in the same universe, but you know, some of the same characters and some of the same storylines come through. But I don't think you need to read the first one in order to read this one. Would you agree?
I agree completely. Yeah. And you quickly pick up what happened in the last one as well.
Yeah.
And it's got what really intrigues, I think, readers out there who are not perhaps familiar with the lore in detail as you are, and that comes through in the book.
Oh, good.
But you know, in the last one, there's a high-flying silk called Godfrey. You had every reason to dislike Jesse Parkin, the young policewoman, and her boyfriend, because he sort of feels he got stitched up, and he wasn't. But so this sort of opens this book. And has she been sent to Coventry? Did she get sent to Kalgoorlie? In Home and Away in the old days, when they got rid of a character, people would say, where have they gone? I say, oh, they've gone to Perth. and suddenly, has she been expelled to Kalgoorlie?
Well, I certainly don't like to think of it like that, and Jessie doesn't either, because Kalgoorlie is a fabulous place to live, and I love it very much. It's my home, and I absolutely adore it. But there was just a bit of a problem with arising out of the circumstances of that were in the previous novel that meant that there was some unwelcome media attention, and Jessie's boss has decided it's best if she is out of Perth while there's an appeal that is playing out.
People, of course, reading it have their own prejudices against high-flying silks and think that's a good thing that somebody got their comeuppance. Lawyers generally, they can be distrustful of.
Yes.
And they'll say, what's going on in the police force? Are these police people actually friendly with each other? Do detectives like each other? Or is it like one football team against another and they're all trying to sort of push the other ones aside?
It's tricky, isn't it? Those sorts of things, you know, I was very much assisted by having a police consultant on this book, because I embarked on writing Hot Ground from Jessie's perspective without really giving too much thought to the fact that I didn't know anything about, policing. I thought I knew a lot. You'd appreciate that as a lawyer, we sort of assume we just know
everything
there is to know about policing. And everything
and
generally.
Everything.
Yeah, that's right.
So that comes through. I mean, the profound reviewers and commentators on books will say, in terms of crime thrillers, this is very procedural. Mm. And it is. It has its moments. And you're being set up and you're being told what's going on and you're learning about the mining regulations. But we'd better start to tell our readers a little bit without telling them too much.
Right.
No spoiler alert.
Okay.
What's the plot here? How do you describe this when you turn up to book launches?
Well, I think the thing that inspired the whole story from the start was this notion of the fact that, you need to... mining tenements expire at midnight. It's just the way that, on the day that they expire, they've got an expiry date and that expires at midnight. So if there is some ground that people have got their eye on, they want to try and, if once it expires, they want to get hold of it, they have to, and there's a bit of competition for it, then people will do what's called a midnight peg, where they'll head out to the bush, to the actual spot that they want to get hold of. A mining tenement is just a right to mine, and you don't need to pay for one, you just have to bang in a peg. But you've got to be out there at midnight. You've got to get the peg into the ground faster than anybody else.
You have to do it in the right way and do it in conformity with the regulations.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it's got to be done exactly in accordance with the regulations as they were drafted over 100 years ago. Well, the law really hasn't substantially changed in over 100 years. So that it's still the case for a prospecting licence, that's how you have to get one. So, there's obviously, people who have been out doing that process have told me that it can be quite spooky.
Well, it's spooky for lots of reasons. My memory and knowledge of the area is if you're heading out there at midnight out of Kalgoorlie, so even around Kalgoorlie, closer in, you're in danger of falling down a disused mine shaft.
Absolutely, yeah. And a lady was telling me the other night that she went out there once and suddenly there was gunfire everywhere, and it turned out there was a roo shooter.
Well, and you'd hope that, yes, they know what a roo looks like and can distinguish it from a human who's suddenly taken off when they've heard the gunshot.
Terrifying.
So how do you describe the plot? I mean, there's obviously some dead bodies.
Yes, yeah, so, the first thing that happens is our prospector goes missing, and we learn pretty early on that he's gone to peg a tenement. Yeah, I guess there's a bunch of other people that are interested in the same tenement, so they become initially suspects or not persons of interest.
POI.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other thing about the book is people are sort of learning about Australia, learning about the goldfields. Mm. Suddenly there's a town called Mount Magnet. But
yes.
I also know
that. I think that actually is Mount Magnet.
That's Mount Magnet
that
on the front cover.
Yeah.
And then you've got Sandstone, then you've got... We've got Laverton, little town of Kookynie, a fabulous place.
You know your way around the goldfields.
Find your way through Menzies, back to Kell, and down the highway to Perth. But you start to look at it all, and then there's this woman who's the daughter of the missing prospector. She's a pushy sort.
Yeah. I kind of liked her character because I felt it was very realistic. Like pushy is a good word for it. It's tempting to make all characters a bit like yourself, but that character is kind of like the sort of people that you deal with in your profession, that they just want something from you and they want you to provide it and they ring incessantly and you can't blow them off.
They want it done today. You tell them you'll do it this afternoon. They ring at 3 o'clock and ask if it's been done.
Yeah, how are you going with it?
Yeah. Well, she seems to be pretty well healed,
Well, she's a station. She lives and works on a station, so she's in a fairly privileged position. Does a lot of flying around
in
her own plane. Yes.
Well, as you do.
Yeah, but this is one thing she can't control. So she's got to lean on Jesse to get something sorted out. So.
There's a character in this book that I really love because after Jessie gets to Cal, she doesn't mess around. She's got a brother up there. She's got friends. In fact, she's got her own connections with Kalgoorlie as a youngster. So she's at the police station. She's dealing with the folks at Perth. She wants to be doing proper work. And she's got a boss, a woman. What's her name?
Tony.
Mm. I have to tell you, I really like this Tony character.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great.
She's an organised woman. She seems to get Jesse. She supports the people who work for her. She doesn't want these people in Perth thinking that people in Kel don't know what they're doing. Mm. She's just very alert to everything around her. We don't quite get her described or anything, so I have my own sense about her.
Yeah.
But I'd like to meet her. I'd want her running things.
That's great. That is super. Yeah, she's actually a character I really like, and I'm thinking of running with her for the next novel.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well. Well, yes. How perspicacious of
her. Yes.
Truly, no, I really liked her because she's there. You just knew the investigation which ensues is not going to go off the rails.
Yes.
She's not going to be pushed around.
No.
She takes no nonsense.
No. And always polite, though.
Always polite. And, you know, my knowledge of the police force goes back to the, in particular, early 1990s. When I was one of the council working on the WA Inc. inquiry in Western Australia and saw a lot of the police. But they're all men.
Yeah.
This book tells me that there's been a cultural revolution.
Yeah.
Or is it still happening?
Oh, no, I see female police at every level now. Yeah, it's definitely...
Running things. And
yeah, yeah.
It's just phenomenal.
Yeah, as commissioned officers and everything. So it's... That's the way it is. And you see them on the beat as they're walking around or driving around. There's often a female.
And they're no longer having to be 6'3" if they're a man. And
no. Or well, maybe not. Yeah, I'm not too sure.
Now, anyone who writes a crime thriller, it must be written down somewhere, I'm sure, that for a start you have to have lots of loose threads. You have to be intriguing the reader, as this book did me. You know, I'm thinking, oh, is it this one, is it that one? You're laying all of these trails, I'm walking down paths, some of them sort of come to a dead end, but they don't. I'm thinking, oh, I think it's this woman, or no, it's probably that bloke. How do you keep a track of all of these loose threads? Because I have to say, my final comment about your book is you beautifully bring them all together at the end.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, it's because I've got a mind like a steel trap, Michael, and it's just really easy for me to keep track of all of this. Yeah, yeah. No, look, it's it takes all my intellectual capability to keep track of it, and I still reread the drafts over and over and over thinking, is there a plot hole? Have I made a logical error here? And it's one of the things I love about it, about the process of crime writing the most, is that, you know, it has to all fit together logically. There has to be no errors and no plot holes. And I love that, of trying to tie it all together and making sure. But, you know, you can be like 2 years into the writing process and suddenly you'll go, oh, my God, that can't happen there because that happened there. That's not possible. And then, panic because what if I had published it like that?
Well, the police probably still do love to have a running sheet. Everything that's happening is on a big whiteboard.
Yeah.
Well, before computers. Yeah,
they actually use these days a lot of really advanced programs, software to map everything.
And when you've got that, you start to see things.
Yes.
So I found myself in the middle of this wondering whether you were running something like that so you can keep a track of your own story.
Yes, there is. Well, yes, I have tried a lot to do that, but it's just always, at the end of the day, it's all got to be in the noggin, that's right.
It's you're caught up in it.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, do crime thriller writers ever change tact? I once asked Jane Harper a question at a writers' festival in Fremantle. Is it true that exactly halfway through a book like hers, like yours, that there's a significant plot development? She said, yes, that's true. I'll ask you whether you agree. And is it ever the case that you still get to that point and you suddenly change course altogether?
All the time.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, all the time, because it's very hard to map out a story, although I have tried with my next novel. But it's very hard to map out a story from beginning to end and then sit down and write it, you know, because as soon as you start writing, your brain starts thinking, oh, this could happen, oh, I know. And then it causes the ideas to start coming, and then suddenly it just clicks, of course, this is what has to happen, and then we go that way, And so you're just off on a different tangent all the time. And often with, you know, but in both novels, I started thinking there was going to, that I knew who the killer was, and then they changed. So
there are moments in the book where I actually laughed out loud. And I thought to myself, there'll be friends, family, and acquaintances of yours who will challenge you. And so they said, did you have that little group, you know, based on us sort of thing? And I thought the answer will be yes. But one said just made me cackle, and that was a group, and they were ordering their lattes or their cappuccinos. Extra hot. And I know people who do just that. Yeah, and it may well be
not
you,
looking
of
at
course.
Anyone.
Well, I'm one of them, because I get so annoyed with the way coffee's served these days. I think extra lukewarm is the way it ought to be. Anyway, that made me laugh out loud.
I think it's always amazing that they serve it as well as they do. You know, the occurrence of error is very low with coffees, I find, and we all have the most complicated orders, and you deliver your ridiculous order, and they and you say, oh, sorry, and they go, no, that's nothing. It's no problem at all.
So there are these nice social niceties that come into it. The good thing about the procedural aspects of it is you're learning about things substantively.
Yes, I like to, you know, give people a bit of new knowledge from the benefit of what I happen to know about.
Well, it helps to set the plot, to know how important it is to peg this thing and how you can lose something valuable, the mining ground, if you don't peg it all, and you need the right
if
people
you don't
to do
work
it.
You
don't want the guy you send out there to do it to be drunk for having been to a long party and having done it wrong, and that there might be others out there. And, and of course, the valuable little prospectors have sold tenements to very big international companies and made fortunes.
Absolutely, they made overnight fortunes.
Overnight fortunes. Mm. And you have all of this intrigue actually going on in the book. You've got people who are trying to set up their own mining companies, you've got people who seem to get established things.
Yeah.
It really becomes more intriguing. There's a point, I reckon, about a quarter of the way into the book when it suddenly moves, and I'm totally intrigued.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you felt that way and made it that far. But yeah, it's I wanted to sort of convey Kalgoorlie and the excitement and the vibe of the place, because, you know, there's this sort of genre of rural noir, which is not what I wanted to write, really. I didn't want to be writing about, you know, a little shitty little town and, you know, small-minded people, because that's not what Kalgoorlie is at all.
You don't want to portray any rural area as a dark, dismal place
where
only bad things can happen. That comes through. You've got interesting characters in the book. There's some nice twists with an important Indigenous part of Australia as well.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like those.
Yeah.
I'll lose a bit of sleep over that.
No, well, it's challenging if you're non-Indigenous to be bringing other people in. I mean, it's hard, I sometimes think, for men to write about women.
Yes.
But what about women writing about men?
Yeah. Well, it's always challenging to write outside of your own personal experience. But in regards to the Indigenous characters, there was no Indigenous characters in Private Prosecution, and I was, totally comfortable with that at the time, because it just seemed that it wasn't. I didn't have the confidence to do it, you know. But when I moved to Kalgoorlie, moved my writing to Kalgoorlie, I've always been in Kalgoorlie, but yeah, I just sort of thought, you know, at the very start, I thought I can't whitewash my story again. I've got to grow up and try and work out, because I've got a lot of Indigenous friends in Kalgoorlie, and they are such a big, important part of that community, as they are in Perth, but, you know, I'm not a part of the Perth community, so it didn't worry me too much. But, yeah, I didn't want them to be invisible. I wanted them to be where they are.
Well, I thought you got it really nicely.
Oh, good.
And someone who does have an appreciation of the area, I thought, that's good. And this is a modern Australia.
Yeah.
Women are in charge of everything. You know, men are learning.
Yeah.
and it's a multicultural society. And I love all the business activity that's going on in Cal. There's something there, actually, for everybody.
Yeah, Cal's a very multicultural place because people, you know, mining, you can qualify anywhere and the dirt's the same everywhere. So... you know, they come from all corners of the earth, and that's part of, I've always felt that's part of what makes Cal such a fabulous, vibrant place, is the fact that, you know, people there are not often born there, they're travellers and adventurers, yeah. I like to think.
Yeah. Well, you just have to enter Kalgoorlie, drive into Hannon Street and head on down, and you know you're somewhere.
Yeah.
Quite different.
Yeah, it's really... The very first time I drove there after finishing university to start my first job, I just remember driving down, you know, drive for 6 hours along the Great Eastern Highway and then driving down the street and all these amazing, this old, you know, old century old architecture is sort of rising.
It's a bit like Fremantle.
It's a bit like that, yeah.
Same era.
It's Gold the same Rush. Era. Yeah, Gold Rush era. These sort of buildings rising from the desert, it's just blew my mind at the time.
It is an astonishing story, what happened there. I mean, people travel the country to get there and it's gone through its cycles, but Cal keeps on going.
Yes, and it's just, just recently there was some stories in the news about all the further reserves they've found in the super pit, because the whole time I've been there, they've been, you know, extending out the super pit's life.
I don't know what another... word for super pit is. Super's not enough, I don't
Yeah.
But you've mentioned already there's another one coming.
Another book,
yes. You've written it already?
No. I've got the idea in my head though, but I've just got to try and find time to get it down on paper.
And I'm hoping Jessie Parkin has a career
yes.
in all of this.
She'll be a major part of it. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And Tony, you think, might
figure? I think Tony will be the main protagonist, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have a crack this time at writing from the third person perspective, because the story I have in mind, there's no one police officer that will be able to, be across all of it.
The story will unfold in various perspectives.
Yeah. I was inspired by Dervla McTiernan's last novel, The Unquiet Grave, the way she's written a sort of an omniscient third person, so each scene is from the perspective of a different person.
Is particularly good for a thriller setting, because you can be very easily led astray.
Yeah, and then you can have the perspective of the killer as well, which, you know, everyone loves a little bit of that.
Who's the killer?
Yeah.
How did you get into this business? Did you always want to write? You've explained how you went and got yourself a proper job,
yes.
qualified in law. Was that your first love and idea, or did you always want to be writing?
I've always wanted to write. I've never contemplated making a living out of it. It's just my passion, you know. I don't know whether you need to have a certain amount of confidence to embark on a career early in the piece, but it took me quite a while to learn how to write properly, I think.
Did you go to writer's school or did you write and review it?
No, I kept on writing and I would get it edited as if I could, whenever I could afford it. Not so much at university. But whenever I could afford it, I would get someone to edit my work and I learned from their feedback how to improve.
So what sorts of things does an editor do for you that helps you to learn and improve?
They just kind of, they don't rewrite it for you, much to my distress. I always thought I just want them to make it really good, but they don't.
They polish it.
Yes, they won't do that. They will not do that, and I've since found out really most of the time the reason is because they can't. Like, if you really, really lean on them and tell them to write something, then they'll do a terrible job of it.
Well, I see if they have to take the characters over. They have to do things that are not in your mind.
Yeah, they, but, you know, everyone's got different skills, and there are good editors and there are good writers, and I've realised that really what you need is you need both, and the editors will say, "Oh, I don't, you know, maybe you should think about this word, or does that make sense, or whatever, and they'll just ask questions really, and then you go through and answer all of their all of their questions, and next thing it's all starting to look really good.
And presumably they say, do you really mean to use a semicolon 7 times in this one paragraph?
Yeah. Yeah.
I love semicolons. What about you?
I love one in a sentence, not more than one.
Well, Lisa, it's lovely to meet you. It's lovely to be holding your book. I'll let you hold it for a moment.
Oh, thank you.
It must be a thrill to look at your second crime thriller, your second novel, your second illustration as an author, and say, wow, I've done this.
I am really proud of this, because I feel that it's even better than my first novel, and I was really proud of my first novel too, and I thought it's going to be a real challenge to top it, but now that I've managed to, and I think that I have, I feel like the sky's the limit. I'm just going to keep going.
Well, I have absolutely no doubt you will. I'm really pleased, as I say, to have met today, and congratulations on the book, and good luck with getting it out and about. People are going to love reading it.
Thank you very much, Michael. Really appreciate it.